have you make out your checks to my defense committee, but I'll be out of jail before you can write the check out. So. We had a meeting earlier today, speaking to a media group on the question of, is the media biased? And particularly reference to the Middle East. And what I would like to do here today is to discuss the character of our enemy. Who it is, where it comes from, and what's the solution to this problem. The agreement that is in the works between the government of Israel, particularly the foreign minister Peres, and Yasser Arafat, is essentially based on the idea that there should be economic development in that area. That is, that there needs to be strong construction of canals and power plants and railroads to build up industry and work in that region for the mutual benefit of all the people in that area. That's the basis, the real basis for these accords. And this, I'm not being chauvinistic when I say that this way of approaching a problem, such a terrible division, is a typically American way to approach a problem like that. And it's typically American, particularly if you go back a little bit in American history. And it's typically American, especially if you contrast it to what has been typically British, or the British Empire approach, which involves the division of people on the basis of race and nationality, the creation of wars in order to continue to maintain power. Now, it's difficult in our time of ignorance, in our time of acceptance of ignorance as being some sort of natural thing. People don't know any history, they don't feel they need to know any history, they don't know any science, they don't feel they need to know any science. This is a catastrophe, this ignorance in our country. It's difficult under these circumstances to bring up things, even if they're very important, and even talk about them. Like, for example, Britain. How are you going to talk about Britain in Southern California? Right? That's a problem, right? Even if you know that it's true and necessary that you talk about that. Really, I think that the most courageous thing that we have to do is to put on the agenda before people for discussion certain kinds of topics that are not on the agenda now. Where the media defines the agenda for what's going to be discussed. It's not so much their slant on things, that's not even the problem. Most of the time, they're not discussing an area of a problem at all. It's just not. They don't report the news at all concerning this, let alone the history, the background, or any reasonable approach to it. So here you have this problem. In the Middle East, on February 25th, one or more people went into a holy shrine, a holy shrine of the Jewish people, which was also a holy shrine of the Muslims, and systematically assassinated as many people as possible with automatic weapons fire while they were praying. That's what just happened. Hundreds of people were shot. How many died, I don't recall, but hundreds were shot. The killers in this atrocity were, of course, trying to break up the peace accords and destabilize the region. They were trying to rescue a certain type of British approach to things and subvert an alternative approach that could be of great value to the world. Now, what we need to do is to understand who did that and what are they. If I say that this is the British doing that, you have to understand what that means. That's not just, I mean, it's not some sort of indirect thing that we're talking about here. It's not a slander or just a characterization. In a sense, this is similar to, we published a book called Dope Incorporated. And that book took up the question of whatever happened. We're trying to understand the dope problem in America when we wrote that book, when EIR did that book. And so we studied the question, whatever happened to the old British Empire opium trade of the 19th century, when they openly went over and made wars to force countries like China to have opium? Whatever happened to those forms of business, to the shipping companies that did that and so forth? How did they leave that business and get into some other type, more legitimate business? And the answer was pretty shocking. The answer was they never did leave it, and they're still doing it. They just changed certain formats. They set up banks in different parts of the world, but they still continued to do exactly the same business. Certain new areas were opened up, cocaine and so forth. The same thing applies in this area, that you have a long-standing British involvement in the Middle East, which people know something about, and I'm going to get into that tonight, which never stopped, even though the British Empire doesn't seem to be a big deal in the world, right? What's the British Empire, after all? Nothing, right? Went out of existence, more or less. Not really. What's the International Monetary Fund? What are international bankers? What is the international media? I'm gonna make a simple proposition on the killers at Hebron. There are two ways that you have to understand them. Number one, they are representatives of a British party. It's essentially British. And number two, they're gangsters. Now, by gangsters, I mean people who run dope, gun running, prostitution, robberies, murder, etc. And there's a political organization of this party within the Jewish community that includes people in very fancy suits. They go by the name of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. And then there's people who wear the clothing of an FBI provocateur like Meir Kahanet, who organized terrorist parties in Brooklyn, and they're still sending guns and people over to Israel to blow the place up. So, but this is a single party. Now, this is of immense importance to us in many different ways. I'm going to write a word on the board here. There's a company called the Hollinger Corporation, which is a sort of board of directors, in a certain sense, for this party that I'm talking about. The Hollinger Corporation is a newspaper publishing company that owns many different newspapers and probably other types of media, but it's the newspapers that we're primarily concerned about here. This company owns the Jerusalem Post, which is the main English language newspaper of Israel. And that, in Israel, the Jerusalem Post is the mouthpiece for the violent terrorist anti-Arab faction, Ariel Sharon, the former general, the enormously fat general. He speaks through the Jerusalem Post. It didn't used to be like that. It was more of a liberal media. Now they call it right wing. But you're missing the point a little bit unless you see the Hollinger Corporation owns it. They also own the Telegraph in London. the Daily Telegraph. They also owned the Chicago Sun-Times. They also owned the Financial Post of Canada, like the Wall Street Journal of Canada, and they own about 80 other newspapers in the United States. This is actually a British and Canadian news company. Now here's the board of some of the people on the board of directors. Peter Bronfman, who owns the real estate, who manages the real estate operations for the Bronfman family of Canada. Margaret Thatcher, Lord Carrington, and his partner, Henry Kissinger, from Kissinger Associates. David Brinkley, Lord Rothschild, William F. Buckley Jr., whose brother turned down our appeal, and so we have to go to, he's a judge in Washington. Paul Volcker, and Lord Wiedenfeld, who is the head of the Institute for Jewish Affairs in London, which is an Anti-Defamation League front operation over there. The London Daily Telegraph is the original source, and this corporation is the original source of the Whitewater affair. That is, these people from England and their representatives in Washington began to publish violent attacks on President Clinton at a certain point when he began to question certain British Empire approaches to things, particularly what was going on in Russia. He said, maybe it's not so great that the IMF is saying that Russia should be stripped bare and people should starve and they should deliver all their worldly goods up to international financiers and gangsters. Maybe that won't work. He just questioned it a little bit. And remember, the chronology is very important, because what Clinton did around the same time as he and Gore both questioned this international liberal establishment program. Pretty wild, right, for Gore to question that? The world is interesting today, right? But it's Clinton first made that question. So he appointed Bobby Inman to be Secretary of Defense, who also questions some of these things, and Strobe Talbot to be Deputy Secretary of State. And Strobe Talbot had said, just before that, he was a special ambassador to Russia, he had said, maybe we need a little bit less shock and a little more therapy. Now, they were talking about the so-called shock therapy that this crowd has been hitting Russia with. And if you keep backing Russia into a corner by saying you should be poor and starve, that welcome to capitalism, all you're going to do is turn them into an enemy, and they've got H-bombs. You want a World War III, that's a good way to get it. Maybe that's not a good plan. He said, maybe that's not a good plan. So all of a sudden, both Strobe Talbot and Bobby Inman were accused of what? Being anti-Israel. Didn't have anything to do with what they were talking about. It's not true either. But you get a sense, you begin to get a sense of the party that we're talking about. Now, when I say that we're talking about gangsters, this is not just using that word in some loose fashion. We're talking about, for example, Meyer Lansky. Who is Meyer Lansky? He's dead now, but who was he? He was considered the kingpin of the... He was the lead financier and organizer for organized crime in the United States. He was born in Poland. And there's a book out. In fact, I have this book right here. Can I bring it with me? There it is. Around the floor. Here. Meyer Lansky. It's written by three Israelis. One of them is Yuri Dan. These people, the authors are Israeli journalists who are spokesmen for this party, They are mouthpieces for Ariel Sharon and the violent, extreme, racist, anti-Arab faction in Israel. And what they say in this book, which is entirely favorable to Meyer Lansky, is that Lansky heard from his parents in Poland about anti-Jewish attacks that were going on all the time and learned that Jews should fight back against these attacks. So that therefore, because of these attacks, whatever somebody like Lansky does is really morally justified. And obviously they're using this to relate to what they're doing, but that's not the only thing. Because you begin to find out that they are closely related to Meyer Lansky in their activities. And you see little incidents. If you don't know anything more than it is in this book, you might not quite figure it out, but for example, when Ariel Sharon invaded Egypt in the 1967 war, Meyer Lansky's organization sent him a basket of champagne and cigars in Egypt. Meyer Lansky's organization. And that's in the book. What's that all about? Isn't that weird? A general in a war? And he was criticized for doing that, too. He had champagne and caviar and cigars from the Meyer Lansky organization in the middle of this war. So how is that related to what we have to deal with in politics? Well, it goes back, again, to this problem that you have, that the most important things that you have to discuss with people are things that they don't even think are relevant to anything. I'll give you an example. Any of you go to the movies, ever? Any of you ever watch television? If you consider the fact that Hollywood was set up and has been run by killers, by satanic killers, that is, people who murder again and again and again and again. They also set up Las Vegas as a coordinated operation. That after World War II, the British Special Operations Executive, that is the secret intelligence service of the British operating out of Canada and England, set up operations for the Lansky mob to launder drug money, to run things in the Caribbean, and to run gambling operations all over the country. And these people directly set up Las Vegas completely. They set up all the lottery operations in the country. Now this is taken on a professional look to it, with professional corporations involved, supposedly not related to these people. But this is the future of the United States. We're going to be doing nothing but gambling and entertainment. You have gambling, entertainment, sex perversion, and sports, 25 hours a day, and no other industry. You don't have to do any other industry. The schools will train people to be workers in those industries, right? If this party predominates. The bootlegging, right, the gangsters, the American organized crime is entirely British. In the 1920s, under Prohibition, you have three principal figures setting that up on this end. One of them is Meyer Lansky, who's running operations with his underling, Lucky Luciano, and Al Capone and various people in different parts of the country, especially as you got towards about 1930, completely dominating that. Then you have the Bronfman family in Canada, and a guy named Arnold Rothstein, who's in high society and goes over to England, and all of those parts of it coordinate with the lords of England, like General Haig, the head British general in World War I. His family runs Haig Scotch, and he's a partner with Bronfman, a direct partner, not a hidden partner. They are a company, 50-50, right? And the gangsters ran all of this under the complete control of Great Britain. Murder, hijacking, arson, constant murders. The amount of murders that were involved in setting up these different things. First, the so-called bootlegging. But then you get into the post-bootlegging operations with these same channels of dope, smuggling, and gambling, and entertainment. All by the same group. And imagine if you say, let's legalize narcotics, that'll solve the problem. Well, how much are you going to leave? You're going to legalize murder, legalize every element of this whole thing. That's not the solution to it. Now, where does this come from? What's the background of this arrangement? You can begin to get the smell of this if you're courageous enough, if you go into your own neighborhood and talk to probably even some of your own friends and ask them about the end times. The end times, right? Oh, there's going to be a war in the Middle East. It says so in the Bible. Whoa, God says that the Jews are going to go back to Palestine. They're going to have a war with the Arabs, and that will bring on the end of the world. That's good, because God prophesies that in the Bible, and that's God's will. That's true if God is the same thing as Lord Palmerston. So that if you see somebody believing that, or telling you that they read about that in the Bible, you have to know enough and be self-confident enough to try to get that person either some sympathetic attention from a professional person, which is yourself, or else at least don't try to get involved in a crazy conversation with them, because they're reciting British propaganda. Geopolitics, that's what's called geopolitics. In other words, the religion that's gotten into American Protestants, heavily in the black community, heavily among Baptists, and of course, it's a certain heart idea of Zionism, right, is British geopolitics. First one who proposed that the Jews need to go back to Palestine was Lord Palmerston, the British foreign minister and later prime minister. In 1840, he sent a letter to the British ambassador in Turkey. Palestine at that time was part of the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire. And Lord Palmerston said, the Jews as a nation desire to return to Palestine. And of course, as Alba Ibn pointed out, the Jews didn't know anything about that at the time. The British then sent troops a month later for the first time and landed them in Palestine. They didn't take it over at that time, but they started to, you know, get involved. Now, after the Civil War, the British set up a very strange organization called the Palestine Exploration Fund. It was set up by Queen Victoria and by the United Grand Lodge of Masons and other people supporting Masonic ideas. What did they do? They went to Palestine, which didn't belong to Britain, it's part of the Turkish Empire, and they started to dig in the city of Jerusalem, dig for ancient temples, dig for any ruins that might be put to a certain use by the British Empire. You know, the Masons talk about restoring the Temple of Solomon, and this is what Meir Kahane and some of these crackpots of the extreme wing in Israel talk about. We got to restore the Temple of Solomon. And then your so-called fundamentalist over here will say, yes, once that's restored, then we can have our end of the world. Right? End times. Oh boy. Why do they want to restore Solomon's temple? That wasn't the last temple. There were three temples. The last time it got closed down was the third temple, not Solomon. Solomon's was the second. Why do they want to restore Solomon's temple? Because I think it might have to do with the fact that Solomon had more than God in his temple. He also had a few pagan gods in there, right? read about that. Whatever it is, these guys from Britain went over there in the 1860s, 1870s, and dug way down. The leader of this, the head of the Palestine Exploration Fund, was a man named Sir Charles Warren, who wrote a book about his experience as the lead. He was an engineer in Her Majesty's Army. Wrote a book called Underground Jerusalem. Another book called The Temple or the Tomb. And he published a book in the 1870s about proposing the colonization of that section of the Ottoman Empire that the British called Palestine in exchange for taking over Turkey's national debt, right? And he said, let this be done with the avowed intention of gradually introducing the Jew, pure and simple, who is eventually to occupy and govern this country. It is written over and over again in the Word of God, Israel are to return to their own land. It's a British Army guy saying this, right? Okay, so now, who is this fellow? This is Charles Warren. He goes back to England. He takes a few trips to South Africa, spends a number of years killing the natives down there and shooting some of the Dutch people. And then he goes back in 1886 to London, and he starts a new Masonic organization, and it's called the Quatuor Coronati Lodge. We still have this area. Now let's write this down for you specialists in the audience. Quatuor Coronati means the four crowned ones. This is a research lodge of the Freemasons, the British Freemasons. By the way, when I say Freemason, I mean British Freemasons, because as of this point in time in the world today, there's nothing but British Freemasonry. There's Prince Hall Black Freemasonry in America, which is very quiet and is intimidated by these other guys. But among white people on the whole planet, with a minor exception in France, don't say Freemasonry, say British Freemasonry, okay? It's British. Anyway, this is a special lodge they set up. This guy was the head of it. He had another job at the same time. He was police commissioner in London. And it just happened at that time that the royal family had a little problem. The grandson of the queen married the wrong person, see? And they wanted to cover that up, and she was hustled off to an insane asylum, and all the witnesses were killed, cut up with Masonic signs all over them. And they said, oh, it's a lone assassin named Jack the Ripper. And it was nice to have a police commissioner who was also the head of this lodge, Quatuor Coronati. Also, they had the assistant coroner who's in the same little group. And he lost his job because there was a big uproar about that, but so what? He helped the royal family out, you know. This lodge went on to do very interesting things. They produced some new groups in the world. You've heard about some of these groups. One group that they controlled was called the Theosophists. Another group that they controlled was called astrology. Astrology had been ended in Europe possibly hundreds of years before. There was some little bits of astrology that would float through France, etc., etc., but at least for 100 years, or much more than that, it was dead in France and Germany. And in the 1890s, the British reintroduced it into Germany and France. Why would they do that? Geopolitics. And these guys write about how they did that and how proud they are of introducing superstition into Europe. There was a group called the Order, capital O, Order of the Golden Dawn. That was organized by this little group in England, this research lodge. And who are the founders and promoters of Zionism also, right? In the sense of having actually undertaken this as a project. This group was later run by Aleister Crowley, is a pretty famous Satanist who came to Hollywood and helped start Hollywood early in this century. There was another, these guys were running Freemasonic and various occultist things in Turkey to shake things up in Turkey and prepare the way for the Messiah? I doubt it. Right? Prepare the way for British geopolitical games and control the route to India and so forth, right? It's a very strategic area, Israel, right? Palestine. Right between Europe, Asia, and Africa. So they had in Turkey all of these crazy false Muslim groups based on the Sufi tradition, run by the British. The B'nai B'rith was there in great depth, run by the British. There was a guy who went down there to Turkey from Germany and became involved with these British organizations, became a Turkish Freemason there and astrologer named Sabatendorf. I don't know if I've spelled it correctly, but he became famous later. He went back to Germany and founded another suborder of this thing called the Thule Society, which is the people who taught Adolf Hitler about the occult. All run by the British. Houston Stuart Chamberlain was there living in southern Germany and promoting, he married Wagner's daughter and was promoting Nazism for the British. All right, so this is what they were doing. Now, the chief Zionist in the period right after this, before you actually got somebody doing something about Zionism, was a man named Lawrence Oliphant. Very strange man who was in and out of America as a spy for the British. And he wrote a letter to the Foreign Secretary of England. Now this will get you right to your neighbor's problem. By the end times, this is what he said. He said that he's a spy, he's a professional spy. His uncle is head of the East India Company. He's a personal spy for Lord Palmerston and then for other British governments. He came here and helped the Confederacy to try to break up the United States. He was all over the world doing these various revolutions and stuff. So he wrote to the Foreign Minister of England. He said that we have to set up a Palestine Development Company as the precursor for a Jewish state. This guy's not Jewish, right? He's a British aristocrat. He says most of the immigrants will probably consist of oppressed Jews from Romania and the south of Russia. He's writing this in 1878. He says financing of this will be easy. Quote, any amount of money can be raised upon it owing to the belief which people have that they would be fulfilling prophecy and bringing on the end of the world. I don't know why they are so anxious for the latter event, but it makes the commercial speculation easy. As it is a combination of the financial and sentimental elements which will, I think, ensure success. And you thought that was your religion or your neighbor's religion. You didn't realize that it was this cheap operation by a bunch of British lunatics, right? Who say God said it. Isn't that amazing? In other words, they attribute a mass murder plan to God. And people buy it all over the place. Okay, now, this guy actually eventually moved to Palestine when he left a cult in upstate New York. He moved to Palestine, wrote books on why men and women should not have sexual relations, and eventually died of syphilis in Palestine. Lawrence Oliphant, a very famous man in the 19th century. Yes, sir?
I have a question. So would I be safe to say that the British also controlled the activities of the Crusaders fighting against the Muslims during the...
No, 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 no. You don't try to take the British back that far. The British problem only starts as we're talking about it now, around 1500, 1600. Because before that, there were other people. Like, the British didn't start the slave trade or anything like that. England was a fine country in times past. And it got corrupted. But let's save that for later, okay? You can finish up this introduction to the problem with the character of Lord Balfour, B-A-L-F-O-U-R, who was British Prime Minister at the beginning of this century, the same time as Teddy Roosevelt was president and Edward VII was the king. And he was a completely insane person. He believed in the end times. He believed that the universe would eventually consume the earth, or the sun would blow up and consume the earth in a billion years. But that's still going to happen, and therefore everything man does is of no value whatsoever, and the universe simply yawns at man. Very strange viewpoint for a human being to have. He proposed that Jews should not come to England. He told this to the Parliament, that what they need to do is go over to Palestine because we have some use for them over there. He didn't like Jews. And then later on, when he was foreign minister in 1917, he was the one who made the famous declaration, the Balfour Declaration, saying the British Empire will look favorably on having Palestine as a homeland for the Jews. He was also the head of the Psychical Research Society. And it was the president of that in England, and ran many Americans who were in that, like William James, the so-called father of psychology. Many of these people are wildly insane and are therefore qualified to be psychologists. Now, what is this party that we're talking about? Does this affect us in other than these types of areas? Let me bring up some California problems. In 1974, 5, 6, I forget what year, there was a young student at Stanford University. He was 19 years old. He was from North Dakota. His name was Bruce Perry. And he had a lovely young wife, 19 years old, also from North Dakota. She's also a student at Stanford, and they're living in student housing for married couples. And one night, his wife was brutally murdered in the church at Stanford University, in the college chapel. It was a satanic ritual killing, and I'm not going to describe the details. It's very gruesome and disgusting. And the body was arranged in a ritual fashion and so forth. Everybody was totally shocked. The police went to this guy's house or apartment to inform him about the murder. He comes to the door and he's covered with blood. He said it was a nosebleed. And when they tested the blood, supposedly it was not his wife's blood type. The murder was never solved. This Bruce Perry went on to become a famous psychiatrist. He is the head of the Baylor University Medical Psychiatric Operations in Texas. He is a national spokesman for the theory that there is no such thing as satanic ritual crimes. Now, this is extremely perturbing, not only because of what happened to him, but because the murder of his wife became perhaps the most famous satanic crime in American history, because it was the opening scene in a book called The Ultimate Evil, written by Maury Terry. In that book, Maury Terry, who was a newspaper man up in New York, got onto that murder by interviewing a guy who was in jail for committing some other murders, a guy named David Berkowitz, who was arrested as the Son of Sam killer in New York City. He'd supposedly killed a bunch of people in New York for no reason. He said, supposedly told the press, there's an evil dog who told me to do this. Well, then when they got into interviewing him, he said, well, actually, I took the fall for this group that I'm in. It's called the Process Church of the Final Judgment. the process, hyphen, Church of the Final Judgment. And he said, he told Maury Terrio, by the way, this woman, Arliss Perry, was killed by people when she, by in this cult, when she interfered with what they were doing. And Charles Manson was in it too. And his whole ideology comes from this. Now what is this, what is this thing? This is a British group that came over from England to America in the 1960s, and it's still around, headquartered now in Canada. But this was a satanic cult. And this guy, Bruce Perry, whose wife was killed by them, is now a lecturer for the Cult Awareness Network. And he spoke at their November conference in Minnesota as an expert on what happened at Waco, Texas. The reason he knew all about that was that the FBI hired him as their expert on David Koresh. Because he is an expert on satanic, or not, excuse me, on sex crimes against children.
He has experience with that, huh?
Yeah, he has a lot of experience in this field of some type. I don't say anything about what his, what happened to him. I don't know. Was he in on his wife's murder? I don't say that. I just know that he's now protecting those who killed his wife. The interesting thing about this is that when you dig a little bit behind these organizations, you find that the Cult Awareness Network is run by the same people who run the satanic cult. The same people. There's a group of foundations and law firms in New York City that fund the Cult Awareness Network and the American Family Foundation. And the same people are the lawyers and protectors and interveners for the cult, the process church of the final judgment. Just an idea of what they say to their kids that they get involved in this. When they first came over from England, they said there were three gods. Jehovah, Lucifer, and Satan. That got to be too complicated. I guess people have a lower attention span, you know, in later times in America, so they dropped Lucifer. He's not as interesting. So you just have Jehovah and Satan. And this is the format that's in their magazine. It's published on a, it was published on a monthly basis. That God is going to end the world, the sinful world, and Satan is going to execute the final judgment, right? And therefore, if you serve Satan, you're serving God. Hey, is there anything wrong with that? Doesn't that fit in with the end times? Who would assassinate mankind in a war? Who would deliberately cause a war that would result in the mass extermination of human beings? Satan would do that, right? You can't blame that on God. That's your end times, right? Pretty sick, right? Pretty silly. And yet some people attribute that, or say that that is fundamental to Christianity. Isn't that wild? Now, where does that really get you? What are you looking at when you look at that? We've had a pretty rough century. You know, we've had a rough century. You go back to World War I, completely senseless war. World War II, massive bloodbath, unprecedented in human history, at least in Europe anyway. And then you have the threat of nuclear annihilation, the times that we're all alive. And a pretty dangerous time right now, right? With people running around murdering people in church. Or in while they're praying, right, en masse, to try to provoke something. Let's see what this party has been doing in this. I would point your attention to a house, single house. It goes by the name of Thorpe Lodge. This is a house in England. And a gentleman named Peregrine Worsthorn grew up there.
A gentleman of the highest type. I have to spell it right here. And he had a mother one time named Priscilla. I probably haven't spelled it right. She married a man who became Peregrine Wurstorn's stepfather, a guy named Montague Norman. And this was his house. That, so this is where Wurstorn became a mature individual and so forth. Montague Norman is famous as being the head of the Bank of England for 24 years, from 1920 to 1944. Longer time than anyone else. Anybody else has just been head for 2 years. Before he was head of the Bank of England, he was a partner of Brown Brothers, a banking company, and that later merged with Harriman to become Brown Brothers Harriman. But his family firm was called Brown Brothers, and the Brown Brothers man from New York would come to Thorpe Lodge early in the century and meet with Montague Norman. They'd discuss theosophy and various occult religions. That he was Montague Norman was a theosophist. By the way, the reason this is quite relevant now is that Peregrine Wurstorn is like the central character in the Hollinger Corporation. He writes for the Daily Telegraph. He virtually personally launched the whole Whitewater thing against Clinton. He also was the one who declared that Germany is going into a Fourth Reich and needs to be smashed. Not Hitler's Germany, because his father put Hitler into power. This democratic Germany needs to be smashed, right? So, in the 1930s, a guy named Hjalmar Schacht used to come to Thorpe Lodge all the time. He was the economics minister of Adolf Hitler. And he'd come to Thorpe Lodge, meet with Montague Norman, daddy, and discuss the budget of Nazi Germany. How are we going to carry on for the next 6 months in Nazi Germany? Oh, great master head of the Bank of England who runs all world finance. And who has given the Nazi German army all of our weapons, our tanks, and our machine guns, sold by British companies that you personally control, that you personally reorganized in the German marketplace until Hitler got to be sufficiently well-armed that he could carry on. And of course, his family firm, Brown Brothers Harriman, Averell Harriman, George Bush's father, and other people, partners of that Anglo-American firm, paid the Nazis as they're coming up to becoming a power, the Nazi Party. So this is the pro-Hitler faction inside of England. There are people who don't appreciate Hitler in England. Montague Norman convinced the various people within the British government that they should go along with Hitler. This is the fanatically pro-Hitler faction. Not pro-German, because he figured that Germany would be weaker under Hitler than a democratic Germany, which was considered to be a threat, because they might become a strong country, a stable country, allied with other strong countries like Russia, China, Italy, etc. Then what would happen if the whole world was a bunch of strong, independent countries? Why would you need international bankers to do any particular thing? All right? Why would they have any power? Well, why am I telling you all this? Just complete on this, on the question of the mental manipulations. In the 1930s, there was a group of foundations in New York City representing Rockefeller and Harriman. One of them is called the Macy Foundation, Josiah Macy, and a few other little firms in New York. And they're the ones that now control the funding of the Cult Awareness Network and the Process Church of the Final Judgment. In those days, they were sending money over to Germany and Austria to set up psychiatric institutes to preach race purification, various forms of racial extermination, and so forth. Money coming through this and from Rockefeller Foundation, all of it controlled by this guy, head of the Bank of England, was constantly coming back and forth to New York to coordinate this stuff. Now, there's a Jewish bank involved in this, the Warburgs, who coordinated the activities of Harriman and this firm in Germany. In this book, they describe, Lansky describes, because Lansky speaks in this book all the time. This is mainly quotes from Meyer Lansky, the great genius of organized crime. He says that in 1935 there was a judge in New York State, a prominent man in the Republican Party, who came to him and says, Meyer, we need to fight Nazism, and you're the man to do it. We're going to give you all the money and legal help that you need, and go fight the Nazis. Pretty weird, right? The head of organized crime? And then he went out, supposedly, and had his thugs go and engage in fist fights with brown shirts, the German-American Bund. And they'd had fist fights, they got on the news. Well, the judge was a guy named Proskauer, and Proskauer was actually in the American Jewish Committee, and that was this party that we're talking about. In other words, these are the people, they made public statements attacking my father and others who were in the boycott against Nazi Germany. In other words, this is the pro-Hitler faction of finance, including the B'nai B'rith and the American Jewish Committee. So these are the people who are supposedly paying Meyer Lansky to fight Nazism, but they didn't want Jews to fight Hitler. They didn't want boycotts against Hitler or anything like that, because they're working with the whole British party that's actually putting Hitler into power. So how'd this all end up? How did somebody like Baruch Goldstein, this guy who killed all those people while they were worshiping, get to be so crazy with racial hatred that he would do something like that? It's not based on religion, because this gang didn't get religion until a certain point. They said, well, that would be useful for our faction. So they adopted this religion at a certain point. They got to be so-called conservatives or orthodox or something. They're not, most of them are former communists, or they're mainly anti-Western types from Russia, like Dostoevsky. Well, what happened is at the end of World War II, there was a certain kind of a project to make people as crazy as possible about what had just happened in World War II. And there was a final meeting at Thorpe Lodge. Now remember, Montague Norman was a theosophist, the principal architect of the Hitler regime, and in fact of the psychiatry that was practiced under Hitler, where they started killing people and training murderers. These were psychiatrists that were coordinated by Anglo-American people. At the end of the war, they had a meeting at Thorpe Lodge to set up what was called the World Federation for Mental Health. The most insane people that had ever walked the face of the earth, right? They set this thing up, and that's what they did there in 1948 is the basis for all mental health and psychiatric organizations today on this planet. One of the meetings they had there was a meeting on the subject of guilt and how to manipulate guilt, how to use guilt. They had a specific session on German collective guilt. And off of that, they published a book called The Authoritarian Personality. That was published by Proskauer and the American Jewish Committee. That is, the pro-Nazi group in America and Britain published the literature telling you about the guilt of the German people for the crimes of Hitler. The keynote speaker at that conference on German collective guilt was Margaret Mead. And the chairman of the meeting was the head of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry's Insanity Project. Project on Insanity, run by Scottish Rite psychiatrists.
he's over from America. So this is a bunch of British ghouls and their American hangers-on. They had Carl Jung was a vice president of this Congress. Freud's daughter, Anna Freud, was a vice president. All the leading British people in the eugenics movement and all the leading British people dealing with building up the Soviet Union, because right after the end of World War II, they didn't have Hitler anymore, so they had to have some new dictatorship in Europe, so Europe wouldn't be republic-oriented, so they brought in communism into half of Europe. That was done by the same group of people, by Harriman, remember? Harriman was the ambassador to Russia. He arranged the Yalta meeting, and this whole little clique. So they just brought in a new type of totalitarianism. Now, what we need, instead of this party running the world or running these terrifying games in the world, is what I said at the beginning was the American approach to these things. What Peres and Arafat are working on, or were working on before this massacre, which is the concept of massive economic and industrial development in that region. Now, can you put that on the table for discussion for people? Oh, well, that's not on the agenda. We're into something else today. We're into end times, we're into environmentalism, all these different concerns, right? Not the American system of economics of the 19th century. Who ever heard of that? Well, I'll give you a hint. Who heard of it? The Irish heard of it. There was a man named Arthur Griffith, who was the head of the Sinn Féin Party, the Irish Nationalist Party, in 1920. And he died about 1922, I think, but he was actually president of Ireland for a little while. He was a real fighter. And he wrote a book about European affairs to try to educate Irish people about what's really going on in the world. And he said in this book, in our century now, he said that Henry Carey, who was Abraham Lincoln's economics teacher, created the modern American nation, and that Friedrich List, who is a friend of Carey and was involved with very obscure types, Friedrich List, a German, created modern Germany. This is this Irish leader in 1920. He also said that the British ran the French Revolution, not the Illuminati, the British. Don't give me any Illuminati. How come the Illuminati didn't overthrow the British government if they're so interested in overthrowing governments and being communists and so forth? And he said that the British Secret Service paid the Free Trade Party in every country in the world to say their nonsense about free trade. The British prohibited imports of manufactured goods into England and dump their trash on other countries to sell it and undermine their manufacturing in every other country while preaching free trade. Until at a certain point in the middle of the last century, certain countries in Europe wouldn't buy it, and so the British had to change the law in England just enough to convince the other people that free trade was on the agenda. And a lot of other things this Irish guy is writing about in our century. Arthur Griffith. You can find him in the Encyclopedia Britannica, but they won't write what he said. They'll just tell you that he existed and he was famous and president and so on and so forth. But gosh, people not so long ago as 1920 still knew about these things. People in America today know something about the British. For example, they know that there are people in America called Anglophiles. And they have some pretty bad attitudes about things. Race attitudes or aristocratic attitudes or anti-Christian attitudes or what have you. They don't necessarily put the one and the two together.
They don't know today what people knew in the 19th century, or they, even if they see it, they don't want it to register because they say, well, how could I tell anybody else about this? So I read it and I forget about it. A simple fact that was known in the 19th century, that Adam Smith, the original of Michael Milken, who said that economics is just about getting rich. And that's all there is to it. You set up your system so that people can get rich who are able to, and that'll work out for the best. And that's all economics is about. But that in the 19th century, people knew that Adam Smith represented despotism, tyranny, reactionary politics, oligarchism, force, British Navy bombarding ports of people and so forth, and setting cities on fire like in China and so forth. That's what was known and understood in the 19th century, and that freedom had to do with having your own powerful government. Your government, not owned by some foreign bank or some foreign power, but owned by your people. And it has its own bank, for example, like the Bank of the United States set up by Alexander Hamilton. This kind of an idea in opposition to the British satanic idea about what man is all about was understood in the 19th century. And it's forgotten about or excused from the memory today. So I would propose, now finally to conclude here, and then I'd like to have an interchange here. I would propose that the solution to this problem of the end times is not to destroy the world and to destroy mankind, as some people think God wants to do, wrongly, because it's the British Empire that wants to do that, or that wants to talk about that, but rather that we should do what God did at Sodom and Gomorrah, which is finish off this end times party.
What party?
The end times party, the people who are preaching the extermination of mankind. This gang, like this guy Baruch Goldstein, like Henry Kissinger, like Lord Carrington, like Lady Thatcher, like George Bush. This is a party, Meyer Lansky party, the people who set up Hollywood. Hollywood as an institution, and this party of gangsters. You have to count the number of bodies, dead bodies, piled up by the hundreds in the establishment of Hollywood and of Las Vegas and of what is being proposed to you for your future by this party. I would say instead that we go back, take a trip to Israel sometime, and you'll see by the Dead Sea there's a little site, and you may see a sign, like a road sign or what have you, where Sodom and Gomorrah were. Now if you look down, as the bus comes over the ridge, you look down in the valley next to the Dead Sea, it looks like God smashed up this area real hard. It just looked just like that. It's in the Great Rift Valley. The whole thing was shaken up all the way down to Africa. And in Hebrew, the words are Sodom and Gomorrah, which means closed and finished. And they don't mean the world. They're talking about those guys. We need to finish off this party, to close this party that we're talking about, so that mankind can live.
Spell the name of that party.
What's the name of the party?
Spell it.
The British Empire. I'll be more specific. British empiricism. Empiricism. In other words, that's a very serious question. What's a way that you can identify this generally? Well, you can identify this in many fields. It's not just a group. It's a way of thinking also. Up until about 1815, Sir Isaac Newton was considered to be a fraud. Cheap. He's called an empiricist. Right? That used to be another word for atheism. If you were an empiricist, that meant that you didn't even pay any attention to any
deeper cause of anything than what you saw or perceived with your senses. And so you're obviously a charlatan in science. But after that period, when you have these characters taking over our universities, and you have the proliferation of British Freemasonry and various forms of corruption in culture, you have all kinds of things presented to people as if they were scientific and great, until in the 20th century it becomes totally laughable and people are embarrassed to even talk about these things. For example, Picasso becomes a great artist at a certain point. He actually was a decent second-rate artist at a certain young age, and then he started making these crazy things on the paper and was promoted by these guys, these oligarchs, these British characters. It's music the same way. Do you ever hear so-called modern serious music? Completely insane, deliberately insane, deliberately insulting to the human mind, to human emotions, so forth. And they say it as if it were the same category of event as Beethoven. Not to speak of, you know, satanic rock music. In every field, particularly in physical science, in the sciences of physics and other areas, completely degenerate, laughable activities in the 20th century are promoted as if they were serious. And then, of course, you have the British empiricist line that's drawn that says that science and religion must be always separated from one another, whereas the classical scientists, the ones who made all the great discoveries, were always deeply religious people. So British empiricism, this way of saying that you should take a cheap view of the world. Life is cheap. Labor should be cheap. Don't spend too much time and effort on doing philosophy when you're going to deal with science. Just pick up what the senses say and publish something. And kill the scientists who are deeper thinkers, or destroy their reputations. That's British empiricism. And the correlative for that in politics is this party. You have the specific group that's involved in the Hebron massacre. You have two political parties in Israel that were just banned by the Israeli government. One's called the Kach party, and the other one is called Kahana Lives, or Kahana Chai, after Meir Kahana. And the Prime Minister of England, of Israel, when they banned these parties of the terrorists, of the Jewish terrorists, they said that the problem primarily of these groups is in the United States, is in New York, in Brooklyn. And they wished that the U.S. government would do something about these people. There's thousands and thousands of people like this in Brooklyn with machine guns. They get their money from gangster activities, and the diamond trade and dope smuggling. They're political provocateurs and they're deep, deep racists. And the Prime Minister of Israel said, Judaism spits on these people. Pretty strong language, right? Well, if he says that, at least what we can do is investigate these people and say, let's try to clean up this party. In the business world, this party is represented by, and in the political world, in the more respectable so-called political world, this party is represented by the Anti-Defamation League, ADL. And if you want to clean up this party, you have to close down the ADL.
Are you saying that these secret societies have been creating these institutions all over the world to create illusions, to mislead man on a global basis to keep the different people fighting each other instead of looking at the real source?
No. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying something much more specific than that. What you just said is what you can pick up from 1,000 different conspiracy buffs, 1,000 different little newspapers, 1,000 different Freemasonic organizations, most of them who are doing exactly what we're talking about. What I say is the following, that for the last 500 years, we'll just limit it to that, there are two opposing ways of looking at mankind and two opposing ways of organizing the affairs of the people. One way is most strongly exemplified by the British Empire. They do things in one way. The other way is the American Revolution and the Union side in the Civil War. Everything that you have been taught in recent times is to try to avoid looking at the world that way. The British Empire, at the time of the American Revolution, what kind of business were they in? What did they do? What was their economic activity of the British Empire?
Trade.
They were trade. They talked about trade. They had ships that would bring things from one place to another. They were also in the insurance business. What was their... What did they sell? Well, one thing that they sold was slaves, black slaves. They had a company called the Royal African Company. It was founded by the Duke of York, and they used to brand the slaves, D-Y. They also got into opium sales, and that became bigger later on. But they were doing that already at the time of the American Revolution. They would also corner the market in certain commodities and take them from somebody cheap and sell them at a higher price somewhere else by somehow rigging something the best that they could. And that was their whole mode of operations. In other words, forms of criminal activities. Now, sometimes today, you'll get some crackpot who will say, you can't judge people in those days by today's standards. Why not? Today's standards are a lot worse than they were then. What are you talking about? These guys run the place now more than they did then. At least then we had a fight against that. Because in those days they were looked on as criminal. Nobody ever thought the slave trade was a decent thing to do. It was a criminal activity. Everybody knew that. That was one side. Now I want this to be crystal clear so there's no way to escape from it, okay? There was a revolution against that in the colonies. Who were the leaders of that revolution? Well, according to the communists, according to Jefferson Davis, and according to the British, all three of whom say exactly the same thing, the leaders of the American Revolution were a bunch of slave owners and slave traders. Right? All of the Southern secessionists, the Communist Party and the British Empire all say exactly the same thing. And it's picked up on a lot of popular radio stations and so forth, and a lot of rap artists and so forth. The American Revolution was led by slave owners and slave traders. Okay. Supposing that's not true, then what? Then you've got a real bad problem on your hand, don't you? You've got a real bad problem. You might have to pay attention to history. It might mean something to you, instead of just being a big ripoff. Oh, well, we don't have to learn anything about history because it's just a big ripoff. The world is a big ripoff. Don't you know Satan runs the world? No, Satan doesn't run the world. God runs the world.
Who's God? Which God?
The God that created the world. I don't know what his proper name is, but I know that there's a God who created this world.
Well, you believe in magic.
Huh? All right, now, there was an alternative to the British Empire, and it goes all the way back to the Renaissance. Three principal leaders of the American Revolution: George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and Alexander Hamilton. Take the revolution from the time of the formation of the organization led by Franklin all the way through the Constitution, principally led by Hamilton. Start with George Washington. George Washington, and these are the three principal leaders of the organization of our country, the beginning. The war against England,
and the creation of a national government. Start with George Washington, the most important Southern politician we've ever had. Right? Don't tell me about Jefferson Davis. George Washington is the most important Southern politician. Anybody who says the Confederacy represents the South is coming from the standpoint of British Freemasonry. George Washington, who couldn't get more Southern, he inherited a slave plantation, right? Born in the South, born in Virginia. What did he dedicate himself to do? To undermine and replace a worldwide British system of slavery. The whole world was a slave system in the British Empire way of thinking. What was his idea? He said, instead of having the cheapest possible labor and the cheapest possible raw materials that we grab from somewhere and sell somewhere else, and that's what we were supposed to do according to Adam Smith, what George Washington said is, let us have canals. He personally did the route for the Erie Canal. He led the fight for a canal out to the Ohio. He said, let us grow corn and wheat. Let us have fisheries. Let us have roads. Let us build industry. And let us have a war against the British Empire, because we've got to have a modern society. His farewell address was an address against listening to intriguers who would want to have secession. Okay, that's George Washington. Benjamin Franklin and Alexander Hamilton, the two of them, were the originators of the anti-slavery society in the United States. Alexander Hamilton, born in the West Indies, the son of unmarried parents, not an aristocrat, possibly of black ancestry, came to America and had a program for opposing the British world slave system. Because he hated slavery, he saw it all around him in the Caribbean. And he did something that the British never forgave him for, never forgave America for. He set up a national bank of our country, a bank of the Republic, the Bank of the United States, which he personally controlled as Treasury Secretary for Washington. And what's the idea of that? Well, if there are international bankers that charge 10-20% interest, no problem. You have your own bank that charges 3% and gets loans out to people who want to build industry and farming. And what's the purpose of industry, according to Alexander Hamilton? And this gets back, again, to the fight with these guys. What's the purpose of having industry and industrial development and technological progress? As he defined it in his report on manufacturers, he said, the purpose of having this industrial development is to have the human mind improved. Because if we live in a natural society, that is a peasant society, where people keep their place in nature and their place vis-a-vis the aristocrats, then each man is an idiot. Each man is maintained as an idiot by his superiors. So therefore, how do you change that? By having variegated, various, thriving, constantly new industries of a powerful industrial type with hundreds and thousands and millions of companies and private farms. And you do that in a country that gets power from that, and you have many countries that have power. And any country can do that and have their own national bank, and therefore not have international bankers dictating to that country. That's the basis for nationalism of a positive type. Now, if anybody says that these people were the slave party or slave owners, and that defines them, not only is it a lie, but it's coming from the British, who were the inventors, at least in our modern times, of the slave system. Yeah.
Getting back to the national bank system, I was talking to someone about that today. How long, like, say you make the conversion, all right, get rid of the IMF type of institutions, and you start making sovereignty out of all these countries in the world, right, with their own national banking, how long would a transformation of that kind of process take for, like, say, a country like Russia, for instance, or Africa? If you wanted to implement that after, you know, people accepted it and said, well, now let's do this national banking for Africa.
Well, LaRouche had a question similar to that at the conference in Virginia, right after he got out of jail. He said, supposing I were elected president, I wouldn't have to even take office, and half of this would be accomplished. Because people all over the world are sitting there with wet diapers, fearing what's going to happen to them if they take action that they should take to defend their country. People are getting assassinated and having their governments overthrown just about every day for trying to do something for their own country. I'll give you an example. Somalia, that we sent our troops there to help feed people. If we had just not had the IMF there overthrowing their government when they tried to oppose the IMF, when they tried to build some dams or have some nationalist program, that would have been helpful to start with. In other words, you have nation after nation trying to take an initiative. Nigeria is taking initiatives now. Sudan is taking initiatives now. They're being hit. You can read this in the Los Angeles Times. Read about Sudan. I'm sure you'll find this in your local paper. I haven't read it, but I know you'll find it there. Right? The Sudanese are violating human rights. All right? Well, what are they doing? Well, they had Helga Zepp LaRouche there speaking, addressing a conference. That's a big violation of human rights right there, obviously, right? Malaysia. This is a terrible violator of human rights. Right? They have a harsh, feudalistic dictatorship. They also have all the national leaders subscribed to EIR. That's a terrible violation of human rights right there. Russia. Supposing any serious force in the West, like, say, the President of the United States, were simply to suggest to Russia, just suggest it, that Russia should do and can do with our blessing what we did to become a power, and not what the Harvard geniuses are telling them they should do, but just do what we did. Every railroad in America was built with government financing. Not just Lincoln's railroads, the national railroads, they were built with federal government money straight out. But the local railroads all over the country, cities and states would finance them. That wasn't the most efficient way to do it. It wasn't communism. That was the American system. You had a partnership, public and private. How come we have steel mills in America? We didn't have them before Lincoln. Why did we suddenly start building steel mills? Because we used to buy cheap British steel. The government put a 50% tariff in, Abraham Lincoln's government. How come we have so many private farms? Whereas a lot of countries, you either have communist collectivism or you have big landowners and only a few, you know, the little guy has almost nothing. How come we have so many private farms? Family farms, or we used to. How do we get that? You had a strategy by people who at various times got themselves in power in our government, like Henry Clay or Alexander Hamilton or Abraham Lincoln, some other people. And their strategy was, let's make sure that the price of federal land that's sold to families for a farm is just the right price so that individual family farmers can afford to get it and big corporations won't buy it all up. Lincoln thought that wasn't going fast enough, so he said, let's just give it to them. If you're a private person, 21 years old, age or older, or the head of a family, you get a quarter square mile of land for free. And we'll loan you the money to make sure you can build a house on it. That was the American system. We had hundreds of thousands of farms set up that way, and millions of farms set up in similar ways. In fact, predominantly black regimes in South Carolina and Mississippi and elsewhere after the Civil War, run by black people, had similar programs for white and black in those states before they were killed off by the Ku Klux Klan. That's the American system. That's how we built up our country. Anything modern here comes from that approach. We tried to do some of that in the 20th century too. We had the TVA, we had the Kennedy Space Program, we have public airports and so forth and so on. Not communism, but the government has a certain role to play. Your nation has a certain role to play. It's the idea of a nation. All we have to do is just suggest, and that's what Clinton just began to question the opposite thing a little bit, and he got slammed. And all the Republicans jump on the bandwagon, right? But if you have this proposal on the table, as LaRouche has been making ever since, right? Going back to 1975 when he went to Iraq, at the invitation of the ruling party there and proposed Arab-Israeli cooperation on the basis of massive industrialization in the Middle East, and Kissinger slammed him and threatened murder to anybody who went along with it. That just has to be put on the agenda. And what, as Martin Luther King said, you have to never let them rest. And that's the way you win. You go after the enemy, these guys, never let them rest, and put the real agenda on the table, and you win. That's what has to be done. Yes? Yes.
One point of clarification I'd like you to comment on, if you would, please. To see if I understood what you were saying at one point when we talked about it. Two or three times, approximately, I got the impression you were equating as to one point. British teachings here about end-time stuff, and the word fundamentalism was used about end-time teaching. You know, about both of those need to be squashed. But actually, fundamentalism teaches 100% opposite. They teach that Christ comes back to stop man from destroying himself and sets up a millennial reign for 1,000 years, which cannot be a destroyed earth. And so it's just the opposite. That is fundamentalism. I'm one of its proponents.
No, I mean, aside terminology aside, what he's saying is true. That this so-called end times doctrine of the Masons and of the British Empire has nothing to do with Christianity. That people who believe in a second coming of Christ based on the teachings of the founders of the Christian faith have a different viewpoint. And it's also part of the Jewish faith. They claim that the Messiah hasn't come yet. But the concept of a future time when mankind will have a better life based on a Messiah, based on God's grace to mankind, is clearly the opposite from somebody who's saying that God is going to destroy humanity, really from the standpoint that God hates mankind and thinks that mankind is not worth having. There's obviously, it's clearly a completely opposite concept. Yes?
Getting back to slavery, where did the Dutch slave traders figure into this? You know, for the literature that's commonly available, I mean, the Dutch slave traders got here before Columbus, and it's always Dutch.
Actually, you had just to illustrate that, you had in New York State had significant slavery. As a colonial state, and I think right even a little bit after the Revolution too. This was Dutch. It was the Dutch influence even after the British were there. Their depot for the slaves was Curacao, and much of the Caribbean was under this Dutch influence. There was a lot of Jews that had fled from Spain or had been kicked out of Spain and Portugal, and had gotten somehow into the Dutch Empire and were in this slave trade. They were carrying out the Kabbalistic religion. But both Holland and England were actually latecomers in this trade. They did not invent the slave trade. The slave trade originates long before there are any blacks in the slave trade. That is, the European trade in slaves starts off with the Roman Empire with various types of large slave operations. And then you have the Venetians, the city of Venice, which is entirely based on occultism and the slave trade, set up by people who were in the slave trade in Rome going to Venice. Venice, Italy, is in many respects the originator of the British Empire, as what we're talking about tonight. And they're also the originator of many of these concepts of the so-called secret societies. That is, their idea of trade and of business is to have the cheapest possible labor, to have weak governments everywhere, constantly infiltrated by their agents, and to run the world on the basis of banking, secret agreements, and secret government. There's never any constitution or any transparent government. These people in Venice, at a certain point, lost the physical power of their empire, very similar to Britain later on. And so what they did at a certain point was to send Venetian bankers, diplomats, and various types of Venetian agents into Holland and England, and eventually took complete power in those countries. Set up companies in Holland and England modeled on what the Venice slave traders did. The East India Company of both England and Holland, and the West Indies Company of Holland, slave traders and looters of Asia, which is what had been done by the Venetians, but also the black slave trade, because Venice was the first European power to do that. 5 years after Columbus got here, in 1497, 5 years after he first landed in the Western Hemisphere, Venetian merchants made an official arrangement with the King of Spain to begin sending black slaves from Africa, 5,000 a year, into the New World. So hardly any white people had settled down anywhere. And there, you have to understand why they did that. If you think it's just economics, you are missing the whole point of this. You know, it's like some communist talking about Africa. Well, you know, the colonials go to Africa in order to steal the raw materials. Well, that may be true, but you could get a lot more raw materials out of there if they had an educated workforce, if they lived in decent houses, if they had an education. Why won't you let them have those things? You could make more money if they did. Well, if they did, they wouldn't need you to run their country. It's power. Power. So the Venetians wanted slavery in the New World because they didn't want the Renaissance here. They didn't want freedom. They didn't want the concept of man's freedom. Because you had another city, Florence. That's the originator of many of our concepts of government. That was opposed to Venice. That said, we have a dark world, superstition, epidemics, cities cutting their budgets, running out of money, being looted by bankers. People dying, half the population of Europe, a third of the population of Europe died in one plague. So the people in Florence said, let's not have this Venetian system running the world. Let's look at these little problems as just part of a huge problem. And it's not going to be good enough for us to propose a little solution. Issues. Oh, stick to the issues, stick to the agenda. No, it's not good enough, they said. We need to solve everything all at once. Nothing else will be practical. Nothing else is going to work. This world is too far gone. So they said, let's build up beauty and science and industry and revive ancient learning and invent whole new industries and get the entire planet moving on a human basis. Make maps. One of these maps goes to Columbus. That's their project. And you have an opposite faction, an opposite idea in Venice. And the Venetian idea of slavery, of secret government, of man's degradation, of cults, of the Kabbalah, and so forth. That gets into England. They take over Britain, and eventually Britain becomes the capital of the slave trade. So, and Holland as well. But Holland, at a certain point, is like a minor partner of Great Britain and of Britain's power. Yes, sir.
I just want to ask a somewhat of a trivial one. One of the things I had kicked back to me when I was talking about Alexander Hamilton was that he, during his time, after the Continental Congress had put out script and so forth, he and his cronies had gone out and surreptitiously and deceptively bought up a lot of this script for nickels on a dollar's worth, when they knew in advance that it was going to be redeemed in full value. What would be a good historical reference to check out the details on that? Because that's a smear as I see it, and I'd just like to be able to deal with it realistically.
There are several books that are pro-Hamilton that you can read about smears of that type. One, Forrest MacDonald wrote a book. There's another book written by a lawyer in New York. That's a generally rotten book, but it goes deeply into supposedly backing up Hamilton. Hamilton is portrayed, if you talk specifically about Hamilton, you can't get into this thing that the founding fathers were all slave owners, since clearly Hamilton was no slave owner and was devoted his life to fighting against slavery. They bring up some other stuff on Hamilton.
They try to say that he was pro-aristocrat or pro-monarchist, or that he was for the big man as opposed to the little man. Now, Hamilton's entire idea was that there should be a republic where the money power would be put entirely at the service of the change of that society. This is a powerful concept. In other words, that you would have a nation whose money and credit would be applied constantly to improving and changing the country. And he said that we have to have credit that people have some faith in. The government has to pay its debts. We have to honor debts. The thing is that the government has to be owned by the republic and not by some private operators. Because if it's owned by some private operators, they're going to get the government into $10 trillion of debts owed to them. For no good reason. He said that debt is a fine thing if you use the credit for the purpose of the development of the country and not for some other purpose. So you have the populists today who make this horrible, horrible mistake of choosing the wrong side in the dispute between Jefferson and Hamilton. And in making that choice, they don't do it like Lincoln did. They choose the British side of this debate, that is, Jefferson's economics, instead of Hamilton's. Whereas what Lincoln did was he said, Jefferson, as a young man, wrote the Declaration of Independence, or worked on the draft of it. That was good. That was against British tyranny and for the rights of man. And then, in terms of economics, you've got to go with Hamilton. That's the right way to look at things. Hamilton himself went with Jefferson later on for a very specific reason. Hamilton himself backed Jefferson for president, even though he was the head of the enemy party, because his own party, the Federalists, was so corrupt that he knew they were tied in with the British and they would sell the country out. And so he said, instead of John Adams being reelected, let's put Jefferson's people in there. At least he won't give the country to the British. Hamilton did that. Wrote a pamphlet attacking President Adams. That he was the soul of the Patriotic Party. He was the brain power in the founding period of our country for the American system against this British slave power. And so the first thing to do really is to read Hamilton himself. That was what started me in being a historian. And this has happened to a lot of people, is that they will read a book about something and they'll form some conclusion about it. And then all of a sudden they will read the original guy and they'll find out that this person has some brains. And he actually speaks to you today. And he speaks in a completely different way than they told you about. So read what he has to say. Because he's fighting a fight. He's fighting a war. Yes, ma'am.
I have heard of the name Brit in relationship to Freemasonry and also the ADL. And can you tell me exactly what is B'nai B'rith?
Yes. B'nai B'rith, which is the words mean sons of the covenant. It's Hebrew words. B'nai B'rith was set up allegedly in 1843 in New York City by approximately 12 obscure Freemasons. The B'nai B'rith was quickly centered actually in Cincinnati in the 1850s. And its virtual sole preoccupation was a very small organization. By the time of the Civil War, it had about between 1,000 and 1,500 members in America. Its preoccupation was to build up the party that was trying to break up the United States. They ran various southern and northern, which were called Copperhead, political operations. And we've written a lot about this. I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail on that. But these people, even though most of the Jewish people in America were living in the north, especially after immigrants came in from Germany, and most of the Jewish people in the Civil War were pro-Union, the B'nai B'rith was entirely pro-Confederate. And many of its leaders were arrested by the United States as Confederate spies during the American Civil War, including the head of the B'nai B'rith operation in Washington, D.C., Simon Wolfe. He was arrested almost immediately upon coming to Washington by Lincoln, by the head of Lincoln's Secret Service. Later on, he was a close friend of John Wilkes Booth, and the day that Lincoln was assassinated, he went drinking with John Wilkes Booth, and they supposedly talked about John Wilkes Booth's personal problems, and a few hours later, Wilkes Booth killed Lincoln. This is a part of the British party in Freemasonry, the British faction in politics, and they're allied to other British operatives. So you can't understand this without, again, going back to this question of Great Britain. Remember that we had a revolution against England, and then a generation later, that was in 1776, in 1812 we had another war against England, the Second War of Independence. They wanted to take the country back. We beat them in that war. Then there was a civil war later on, 1861, and the British supplied guns to the South. They wanted to break up the United States. They didn't want to have any free countries anywhere. They didn't want to have any strong nations anywhere. So they whipped up the Southerners to fight against the United States. They lost that. They didn't give up. They still had, in fact, they had more and more power as an empire. And they have these factions. Now, I was talking earlier about their faction among the Jews. The Jewish religion is a survival from ancient times. In various, there's various complications to it, but it's essentially identified with the Old Testament. Well, these people are not religious. The B'nai B'rith is a social organization, a political organization, and the basis of the B'nai B'rith is a political manipulation of race. They have a committee called the Anti-Defamation League. That's a committee of this B'nai B'rith. In the 20th century, when this Anti-Defamation League has existed, they have specialized in saying in public that certain people were anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic. And they're very selective about this because they didn't participate during the time that Hitler was the dictator of Germany. They didn't participate in the movement against Hitler. They also participated in the Ku Klux Klan. They also blackmailed J. Edgar Hoover, who had certain sexual problems and certain personal problems. Gay Edgar Hoover. And you'll find that the gangsters who make up, I'll give you an example of one of these guys, Morris Dalitz, D-A-L-I-T-Z, got the award from the B'nai B'rith, from the Anti-Defamation League. They call it the Torch of Liberty Award, because he gave him a lot of money. But also because he's an owner of Hollywood Productions. He is he's the main corporate owner for Meyer Lansky in Las Vegas. He is one of the five or six chiefs of organized crime in America. There are other people like Kenneth Bialk and others. Organized crime of the Meyer Lansky faction, that is Jewish organized crime, is represented in the political world by this Anti-Defamation League. Now, what is their religion? See, this is where you get down to the brass tacks of the thing. In New York City, they had a chancellor of schools recently driven out of office by the voters and the parents because he was promoting something called the Rainbow Curriculum. Sounds vaguely like Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition, right? Good liberal mishmash, right? Well, this Rainbow Curriculum promoted the idea that the children should be taught to be comfortable with homosexuals, with adult homosexuals. And the parents thought this was not a good idea.
a lot of the people promoting that were members of the North American Man-Boy Love Association, who were pederasts. The Anti-Defamation League fought for that curriculum, helped to produce that curriculum, and fought against the people who didn't like it, including Jews, Christians, and others in New York City. Now, what's the religious basis for them doing that? Well, you have to understand what they represent. In the real world, they represent what I've been talking about tonight. These are thugs representing this traditional party of criminal activities associated with the British Empire. You've had this throughout time immemorial. You've had people who are associated with crime and who would say that they have something to do with religion, but they represent something different than that. You cannot understand these things without studying their history. And you have to ask the certain theological and other questions about them, certainly, but you have to see what they do in the real world. And they are the party of organized crime in the United States. Yes, in the back.
Yeah, you touched on Hollywood's role in connection with the British.
Yes.
I just want you to kind of elaborate on what role does Hollywood play in this?
First of all, Hollywood movie theaters, Hollywood movie producers, rather, start with the D.W. Griffith film. We've had a lot of talk about that. And Sam Goldwyn and the other people at MGM promoted that movie. That's how they got their money. That's how they started in their business. They were themselves associated with Great Britain. The movie industry itself gets its strategy from British Empire characters who are over here constantly in the United States. One of them was Aldous Huxley. There are other think tank members and strategists who are involved constantly in the movies. What I would do more than that is call your attention to two facts. One of them is the financial structure of the film industry, where money to pay for movies comes from laundered drug money. And the entire drug money laundering apparatus in the world is British. It's entirely British controlled. The banking industry offshore, the coordinated gambling and dope money laundering is British control. We published a book about that. That's one aspect of Hollywood. The other aspect of it is, what do we see in our time, starting in the late 60s? We see a destruction of American culture, all right? We see a massive proliferation of drugs, and you hear people who are in this drug operation coming up with the excuse that there always were drugs, which simply avoids the fact of a massive increase in dope going into the community in our period of time. It just avoids the fact of it. What launched that was a project American agencies like the CIA participated in, American doctors like the Scottish Rite in Boston participated in, psychiatrists from that, American institutions. But this is a British project called MKUltra. It's run by the British Special Operations Executive that had been involved in this type of thing since World War II. Aldous Huxley, H.G. Wells was promoting this before a long time ago, but the point is that the British had the idea that American society was too much oriented to the power of reason and technology. They criticized the space program, they criticized our technological advancement, and they ran operation after operation to bring here a new form of culture, which we got in the 1960s and beyond that. And you have to, that is what Hollywood really is today. We would never have tolerated what you have on the screen today. Horror movies designed to make you insane with fear. Music
promoted by Hollywood promoters, designed to make you insane, to make you a sadist, to make you some type of an animal. We would never have tolerated these things without the drug culture and without a whole series of British initiatives in the United States, one of which, of course, happened 1 month after Kennedy was assassinated, which is when Ed Sullivan brought the Beatles over here. Yes, sir.
It's kind of in regards to this brother's question over here, but
yeah.
We came in late, so I'm not sure I understood as far as the conspiracies about setting up these different organizations. You said that was not the Illuminati?
Well, we've been talking about, we went back to the case of the attack against President Clinton, the Whitewater affair, so-called, and showed that you have British newspapers and a newspaper company run by the top ranks of British society that's also heavily involved with Israel and Zionists. It's all completely run by the British for purposes of stopping the United States from having any kind of initiative in the world that would get rid of this British party's power. You can take this back to what they did to set up Israel and Palestine as a Jewish state in the first place, what British objective was for that. We also went into the background of the people involved in the Hebron massacre, and we showed these exactly the same people, that these are the same people that ran organized crime in America. And then if you have to understand this, you have to look back in the 19th century, the previous century to our own century, and you will see that throughout the world, there was two main forces fighting each other, the British Empire and the United States. And the United States had its sympathizers in other countries. Like in Japan, for example, there were people in Japan who said, well, why don't we try to imitate what the US did? Let's make a modern society. They actually had a revolution in Japan called the Meiji Restoration. How'd that start? And they wanted to modernize Japan. What happened is in the 1850s, America sent some ships over to Japan under Commodore Perry. And not the way the British would send ships. Now, this is the American system. They sent ships over there with a railroad, a telegraph set, and a lot of guns on it. Now, the British would send ships with guns on them, but not to give to the people. They'd send them there to shoot them, right? And so we sent a railroad, a telegraph, and guns. And we said, okay, these are what you will have if you get involved with Western technology. Now, you're going to need these because the British want to enslave you, and they're now bombing China to force them to have opium. We set up a treaty with Japan. And a guy came there as the first consul from the United States named Townsend Harris, right after that, to make this treaty. He was the inventor of City College of New York, very distinguished Christian man. Went over there, made a treaty with them. No opium to be imported into Japan. Why? What's the U.S. interest in that? We don't want Japan to be subverted to the British, then the British are going to, this evil empire is going to run the whole place over there. We want to have some allies. Therefore, we need free countries that are powerful. You got the idea? Is that the way George Bush thinks about the world? No. You can't have any free countries anywhere. They might get uppity. Who knows? Under George Bush, what's the theory? Just 1 second now. What is the theory of the United States with regard to the world for George Bush? What countries are our allies? Britain. What else?
Britain.
No other country. No other country. Think about it. Is it Israel?
No.
Not really. He didn't care for Israel. You know, he did a lot of deals with Israel. He had gun running with Israel and so forth, right? Massive billions of dollars were sent. The only country in the world we actually sent foreign aid to was Israel. You know, these guys saying, oh, let's stop giving out foreign aid. What country do we give foreign aid to? Every country gives more back to the international banks, except Israel. What do they do with the money? Buy guns. What do they do with the guns? Sell them to Central America or something, right? And shoot the Arabs. But that's George Bush's idea of a world. That's the British idea of a world. What's Abraham Lincoln's idea of the world? To have nations. To have nations each nation to have its own, to mind its own business, but to have trade that's mutually beneficial. You can't have a powerful slave system in the world and have that work. Because if some country has the idea of having the cheapest possible labor, that will destabilize the entire world system. You have to stop that, or you can't survive. You can't have freedom anywhere.
That's where we are headed now with gas.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's where we're headed. Yes, sir.
With all that you've said, including the Fort Lodge, the ADL, you know, I see our timetable accelerating to where we may never be able to do anything about it. And if you could weave in Tavistock and how OBE by the B'nai B'rit is weaving into our educational system, and our children will become brainless slaves.
Well, not necessarily. Here, yes. You said Tavistock. When they had this last meeting in 1948, they set up the World Federation for Mental Health at the House. Montague Norman organized that whole thing. He appointed John Rawlings Rees to be the president of the World Federation for Mental Health. That was the director of the Tavistock Institute, the psychological warfare department of the British Army, at a psychiatry clinic. They define in this clinic a lot of programs for education, children's education. We have this pamphlet about outcome-based education. There's a photograph of one of the educational exercises somewhere in the United States designed by these Tavistock characters from England. And they're lying there on the floor simulating death as an educational experience. Well, I was in Michigan a couple of weeks ago, and there was a revolt by some of the students. They walked out because they were going to sell the school to a group in Baltimore that practices this kind of thing. Literally sell the school. It's going to become privatized to a group of people who have this type of exercise.
Michael Milken.
And yeah, Michael Milken pays teachers everywhere, many, many states, to do this type of thing. But one of the young men who led that walkout in this little town in Michigan told me that, oh yeah, we have this type of exercise 3 times a week. But I sleep through it. I don't meditate and I don't simulate death. I just sleep. And most of the kids do too. The point is that that to the extent we have a political operation going in the world, this stuff doesn't have a chance. This completely rests on complete quietness of the population. And the only way that you're going to deal with that is with an incessant, constantly building up political fight that we have to do here in the United States and in every other country in the world. That's what we're doing. We're doing this all over the world. So these guys are, in my view, these guys are completely finished. The only question is the timetable. That is, we're bound to win. The question is, can we do it fast enough to avoid really terrifying tragedies in the world? That's the way I look at it. There's no guarantee when we're going to win. That's on us. We're bound to win because the system that these guys propose, for example, in economics, is completely unsound and cannot stand on its own two legs, because they deliberately don't invest in production and science and so forth. So it's up to us to determine how fast we win. Yes, sir.
You were talking about the American system, you know, but at the same time, I was kind of wondering, you know, sort of about what's called a black legend.
Yes.
And Lyndon LaRouche's method of economics to go over and prove that the black legend wasn't actually, you know, says as it was stated. Do you have any update on that right there as to how that correlates?
Yes. Say something on that. Black legend means, historically, it refers to the theory that the white Christian Spaniards, Catholic Spaniards, came to what is now Latin America and persecuted the Indians dominated them, massacred them, claimed to be spreading the Christian religion when they were only trying to rip them off, and got rid of this wonderful indigenous Indian culture, which now is trying to fight its way back to freedom. That's the black legend. Now, the originators of this black legend are the British. They're, in a certain sense, it's a mirror image of exactly what they did everywhere they went. They massacred the natives. They tried to impose something on the natives. It wasn't ever Christianity. So there's another correlative, because in the black legend, they don't say that the Spaniards were really interested in spreading Christianity. They sort of leave that in a vague way. It's all slavery, destitution, and so forth. The heart of this is a very important thing. It's not a minor point, because this is something that people are terrified to discuss. Partly because there's a big anti-Catholic rap in the black community as well as the white community, right? The Masons spread this stuff. It goes right through the Masons. It comes from England. It goes through other channels. It goes through the Protestant Church also. You are told when you go to school that you do not have the right, and you're told this by the media as well, that you don't have the right to compare one culture with another and say that one culture is better than another one. That's racist. Now that's an insane way of thinking. The way this applies to the black legend is to say that the Christian Spaniards who came into Latin America and intermarried with the Indians, forming a new so-called race of people. I don't go for this race thing. There's only one race of humans. Forming a new color or a new color scheme or whatever it is, right? that they got rid of this wonderful native culture. Well, there was in the Americas, in some parts of the Americas, at certain times, a relatively advanced culture. There were the Olmecs who had a calendar. There were other people who made accomplishments, none of which would be approved today by the British or by the environmentalists. They studied astronomy rather than astrology and so forth. They built cities. In some places, they fell to great depths of degradation. For example, the Plains Indians. If you would want your children to live in the degradation of the Plains Indians, forget about the white man's role in anything to do with them, who did not have settled agriculture but chased buffaloes off cliffs, who lived in a state of warfare. Not all Indians did, but some of them did up there. Much worse than the Plains Indians, the Aztecs in Mexico, who practiced satanic, not just rituals, but sadistic satanic acts, and were the scourge of neighboring peoples, including peoples that had had a higher culture and had invented technologies and cities which the Aztecs took over and did not invent themselves, and are given credit by a bunch of anthropologists who hate all dark-skinned people anyway. Now, if you were not to say that the European culture, European Christian culture, that came into Mexico was better than the Aztecs, that brought in churches, that brought in music. You ever hear a mass written by a Mexican composer in the 1700s? You should, they're beautiful. Do you ever see some of the churches they built? They're beautiful. Do you know that Mexico outlawed slavery? Spanish Mexico, not Aztec Mexico. Aztec Mexico is based on slavery. Spanish Mexico, Christian Mexico, Catholic Mexico, outlawed slavery.
Huh? What year?
What's that?
What year? When?
As soon as they had an independent country. 1811. So, now, are we not able to compare the Christian culture to the Aztec? I think we should. How can you prove that that's the right thing to do, that's moral and not racist? Let's compare a few, make a few other cultural comparisons, which are your, by your politically correct school teacher or media says you're not allowed to. Let's compare the culture of the United States of 1994 to the culture of the United States in 1963. Yes. We're a lot worse than we were. We don't know as much. We're not as moral. In almost every sense of the word. Life is cheaper. We don't believe in preserving human life. We have mass abortions. We have mass pornography. We have mass drugs. We have mass homosexuality. We believe in killing grandma, and half the population agrees in this now, right? Euthanasia. We don't know as much. We don't know as much science, foreign languages, and on, right? So the culture has declined. I think we can reverse that. But you've got to be able to compare what we were in the era of the Kennedy space program and the Martin Luther King civil rights movement, which uplifted our country and was an example from past times also. We had things similar to that. So our culture is worse today than it was in 63. Let's take Germany. Compare Germany 1943 to Germany 1798. Aren't you allowed to make that comparison between one culture and the other? It'd be pretty stupid if you couldn't say that the culture of Hitler was worse than the culture of Beethoven. Same country, but different culture, right? Can you make a comparison and say one culture is more moral, is superior to another? You better, or else you've lost your whole power of judgment. What are you, insane? So the black legend is based on these British characters like Aldous Huxley, and also some people in the Catholic Church, like certain Jesuits and so forth, who have this idea of cultural relativism and ethics, medical ethics, like Georgetown University, where human life is cheap. Right? Yes. Well, the British Empire is the chief source of this philosophy in our time. Absolutely. And of this war against the Christian faith, which they call a war against the Catholic Church. Yeah. All right, here, let me ask you. Go ahead.
Yes. Yes. Has Mr. Rabin criticized the ADL?
I don't know that he's criticized the ADL by name. I know that there has been a big shakeup in American Jewish life in a very short time. There was a big crisis in the Zionist Organization of America. There was a big shakeup in the AIPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee, where they fired some of these provocateurs, you know, so-called pro-Israel. They were so pro-Israel they wanted to blow Israel up, right? And the Israelis don't appreciate that. They have a country to run. That's the way they see it. And the interesting thing is that Peres and Rabin come from the same party, but they live in the real world. The real world is not based on evil. The real world is based on people going to work, producing a product, feeding their families, and trying to maintain some type of stability, right? If you don't do progress in science, if you don't do great philosophy in religion and science and so forth, if you don't make progress, you fall into a dark ages. So they get to the point where these crackpots are running all these dirty operations. I think now it's obvious that people representing the Israeli government are operating in the United States in a real sort of a reverse favor for all the good things that, you know, these American Jews, so-called, have done for Israel. They've got Israeli government agents over here working against the ADL to a certain extent. You had a guy down in Texas, in the Jewish Federation of Houston, just a couple weeks ago, had a speaker from Germany who had been in the German resistance to Hitler, the White Rose Organization, He came to Houston to speak at the Jewish Federation, and he said that the idea that Germany is overrun with neo-Nazis is a lot of baloney. There's no such danger. And the idea was to try to counter this hysteria promoted by Meyer Kahane and the Anti-Defamation League for fundraising and other purposes, that everybody in the world who's not a Jew is a Nazi, particularly Christians, and that Christianity itself is the same thing as Nazism. They said, wait a minute, if you promote that, all you're going to get is Nazism. Yes, ma'am.
What is the relationship between the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers owning all the banks and all that, and of FEMA and all of this? Is it all tied into Britain too, or what?
Well, you want to be specific about some of these famous names. I'll respond to that. The Rothschild family is not an ancient wealthy family. It became a powerful family in the really in the early 1800s. They set up a private intelligence operation in Europe, but they became very powerful chiefly because they were, in a sense, the private brokers and bankers for the crown, for the British royal family. And in a sense, they made the British royal family a lot richer than they had been. And there was a sort of a mutual benefit operation. The Rothschilds in the 19th century were widely understood in the world as representing the British crown. Now today in America, you would see people, Spotlight magazine, for example, might identify the Rothschilds as representing, they might, I don't know, some, it depends how something is written, but they might identify the Rothschilds as representing the Jewish money power. They might say the same thing about the Warburg family, which is pretty interesting, since the Warburg, Max Warburg, the head of the bank, was also the vice president of Hitler's Reichsbank in the 1930s. So you'd have to come up with a real complicated conspiracy theory there, you know, as to why the Jews killed off the Jews, right? That's not the point. You have in the world this British Empire, a great power. Until recent times, with great fleets and the ability to raise great armies, usually using some colony, not their own people. A lot of money and a lot of agents and so forth, but tremendous political power in the world. And the chiefs of this empire were bankers. They called them merchant bankers. They're not like the banker down the street. These are people that deal in trade and have control over masses of commodities. And then you have people in America like the Rock, and so you have some of these are Jewish, some of these are non-Jewish. These are in the British ruling circles. All right. Then you have Rockefeller, and Rockefeller rose to power in the late 1800s in the United States. He had a British partner, and he began getting British financial support. For what? He was a businessman in Cleveland. His business with a British partner and with British money, his business was to steal other people's oil. And he set up a refining business and a shipping business to channel other people's oil wells and their products into his control, his financial control. In the beginning, he never drilled an oil well. And he came to dominate the entire American oil business that had been originated by a bunch of industrial and Republican patriots in Pennsylvania who were scientific people and who wanted to do some good for the country. Rockefeller stole their industry from them with entirely British backing. And then the British faction on Wall Street said to John D. Rockefeller, people don't like what you're doing. They think you're a thief. What you need to do is have a foundation. that will do some good in the world and will look like it's doing some good, and you got to turn that over to some British people to run. Turn over all your money to these people, and that'll do some real good. And the Rockefeller Foundation then was a fund of money that ran the Rockefeller family. That's the way it really works, is that the money runs the family. The family devotes itself to the money that's passed down and to the projects of the family, but there's a fund that's operated by some of the members of the family and by some experts in finance and by some political experts and some dirty tricks experts and so forth. Each one of these families that gets to be like this in alliance with the British. Family funds. And all of these people have an idea about what they want to do in the world different from the American Revolution. They're opposed to the American Revolution. They're opposed to the concepts that are in the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. And they're always allied with Britain. Like they wanted to have the U.S. go to war in World War I on the side of England against Germany. That type of thing. So in the case of Rothschild and Rockefeller, they come from different origins, but both of them are identified politically with the British Empire. Exactly, yes.
How does the IMF run? I don't know, you know, we always keep talking about it, but I don't know how it's run, by whom or where, or how come. Or...
Well, right now it doesn't. That's the crucial thing. The crucial thing is that this thing has come up to a real dead end. The IMF was set up at the end of World War II as a way of, as part of a whole system, the Bretton Woods system, of having a coordinated world financial system under British control, or British and Wall Street control, but Britain controlling Wall Street. And it's come to the point where the IMF represents a lot of bankruptcy. It represents a lot of banks that have assets that are very bad, a lot of them paper assets, real estate assets and so forth, third world debts and so forth. They can't collect the money to make good on that because their whole philosophy has been speculative and not building up the power to produce. They've run into a dead end. What the IMF does in each country is to go to a national government on behalf, they represent all the big bankers, private bankers. This is a world, sort of a world banking authority. Well, it's actually headquartered in Washington, D.C. Isn't that disgusting? All right? But it doesn't represent our country. They go to each nation. And they will tell the national government, you better make a deal with us to cut out 50% of your education budget, to another deal to turn over most of your national industry to a private owner who's a foreign owner, to sell your crops on the market and stop getting into most of the kinds of businesses that you do. And for extra persuasion for this program, there'll be somebody from the Anti-Defamation League there to carry on a destabilizing political campaign against the government or something like that. They may overthrow a government or assassinate somebody. And increasingly, the problem they run into is that the results of this kind of extortion campaign are so tragic, so obviously tragic and dangerous, that even the most ordinary establishment types, members of establishment organizations, you know, Bill Clinton is in the Trilateral Commission, right, all you conspiracy theorists, right? But people can see this is leading to annihilation. The IMF is supposed to be representing responsible world finance. And you have editorials will appear in the Los Angeles Times criticizing somebody for daring to suggest, this is before Clinton, for daring to suggest that somebody should go against the IMF or go against the Federal Reserve or something like that. But mainly you're talking about the world system of the IMF, right? So now you have ordinary people seeing what they've done in Russia. Imagine the IMF going to Russia and telling them, you have to be poor, you have to be desperate, you have to sell half your country to gangsters, literally to gangsters. The IMF tells them that. They have experts coming there and telling them that. And Russia has H-bombs with missiles pointed at our country right now. They're poor because under communism, they went into this crazy program of a military buildup without the most advanced science. If they'd taken LaRouche's deal, they would have had a joint operation with the United States. Could have solved this problem. So they went bankrupt. Their country is desperately poor. The IMF comes in, they still have H-bombs. They still have an army, that's about all they have. They put all their eggs in the military basket. So the IMF goes there, and they get Jeffrey Sachs from Harvard, and George Soros, and other speculators and scum goes over there with the IMF bankers, and they say, welcome to the West. Now you've overthrown communism, now we're really going to get you. You got to give us everything you have and die of hunger.
Wait a minute, the IMF is really trying to collect debt, are they not?
They're not. That's not a good way to do it. They're trying to, but they're not going to succeed that way.
That's their only reason for being there.
Not really. I don't think that. Well, that's a format. It's a logic, but it's clearly not logical because to collect debt, you have to make an investment. You have to, for example, if you're in the mafia. And you loan somebody $5 and expect to get $1,000 repayment. You might get it, but you can't do that for a whole country. If you're in business and you want to collect debts over a permanent period of time, you need to invest in something where people can produce
a
profit.
But in the past, the IMF has made a lot of loans to Russia, to China, and to South American countries.
How big?
Which country have they loaned money to develop the country?
I don't know what it was for. Maybe Mexico's debt was sold to the IMF. I don't know, but their Mexican bank debt used to be about $85 billion when they defaulted in August 82.
Okay, now here's the crucial thing. This may seem like a slight difference to you, but this is the crucial thing. And this is what I was getting at with Hamilton. It's different from the British system. Your country has sovereignty. Your nation has a sovereign power based on the people, right? The people constitute themselves the nation. The nation, hopefully an elected government of responsible leaders, has a certain kind of sovereignty. This sovereignty has a crucial decision to make. That decision is, what shall we do with the credit power of our country, of our sovereign nation? Because that decision decides almost everything. You could go two directions. You could either use your credit power as it should be used, as a power to hire people to work productively so that they can do agriculture and industry and inventions and science and teach children to be scientific and inventive, to be geniuses, hopefully, a lot of them. That's what you use credit for. Or you say that credit is there for those who are powerful to use as they desire. And those who have a power that is apart from that type of national sovereignty idea and development idea are of necessity gangsters. So there are really two systems of credit, the system of national sovereignty and development, or the crime system. So if you say, I don't know what the money was used for in a country, you've missed the crucial distinction, the basic distinction.
Sent back to the United States.
Yeah, they sent the money back to the United States, going through certain corrupt local hands and so forth, but they end up sending the money back to these banks. Right, and to criminal circles as well. They also, a lot of it gets into the drug circle, the drug circuit. That's the crucial thing, that distinction on the use of credit. And when Lincoln made greenbacks and credit available in large quantities, contrary to what is promoted in our Economics 101 courses, they claim that caused inflation. On the contrary, the system of massive credit to set up factories and farms to get people productive. That system is the only way to defeat inflation, because you set up a power, an engine of production, so that every year steel becomes cheaper, because you make it better. You have more modern facilities. You know how to do things better. And you charge less for a product of industry because you can make a profit making more of it and making it better. That's how you beat inflation, is by more brains. You don't beat inflation by stopping people from having credit. In the back? Yes.
Yes, please. I'm appropriate for this last person, I hope. I've heard somewhere that actually a lot of American development, let's say in the 19th century, maybe even earlier, was financed by the Russian Tsars, and that we therefore had a sizable debt to Russia until the revolution in Russia, and that some of our, as you say, gangster type so-called leaders in this country wanted to promote communism and the revolution in Russia so that they could say, well, we don't owe you guys the money, we owe it to the Tsars. The Tsars don't exist anymore. And so they got rid of the debt that way, supposedly.
Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to take this topic up, because it's an important topic, but it's a little bit different than the way you said it. But it is important along these lines. First of all, there is a myth that American... I've never heard, frankly, this story about the Tsars paying for American development. However, there is a myth that the British paid for American development, including the Rothschilds. And, of course, you know who says that is the British and the Rothschilds, right? They say in particular that the Rothschilds and the British, or either the Bank of England or the Rothschilds, paid for the railroads to be developed. Now, as I said earlier, American government, either national, state, or local, played a role in every railroad development. We had things like the Army Corps of Engineers and similar organizations, Army engineers participating directly in much of this. We did have a Bank of the United States twice, in two 20-year periods, crucial times in the early part of our country. And that bank coordinated private investment in things like railroads and industry. They did go to foreign countries to get investment capital. And in fact, Nicholas Biddle, the president of the Bank of the United States, was very popular in England among the middle class, not the Bank of England characters, but the middle class, because they could make money investing in American railroads. It caused a big problem for the British, because you can make prosperity for everybody doing this kind of system. Now, there's also a slander about the Bank of the United States. It's also, unfortunately, promoted by a lot of populists who claim that the Bank of the United States was controlled by foreign bankers. Absolutely untrue. There's no proof of that whatsoever. The fact is that the exact opposite is the case. The exact opposite. That the Bank of the United States is the only hope of the world for stopping foreign bankers from dominating your country. It's precisely the opposite of what the populists say about that. Now, the United States did have an important relationship to Russia. The first railroad in Russia was built by the American Army Corps of Engineers. In the 1840s, George Washington Whistler, who had been an engineer in West Point, and he had built earlier the first American railroad along with some other West Point engineers, appointed by President John Quincy Adams. This is the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, first American railroad. In the 1840s, a little bit later, he was hired by the Tsar to go over to Russia and build the first major Russian railroad from Moscow to St. Petersburg. And they brought locomotives from Philadelphia. And he died in Russia. His son was a famous painter, Whistler, who made the painting Whistler's Mother. Russia repaid that debt to America in the Civil War by sending their fleet to the San Francisco and New York harbors to demonstrate to Britain and their puppet France that they better not get involved in the American Civil War on the side of the Confederacy, or they'd have a European war on their hands. America repaid that debt to the Russians by having the guy who built the Union Pacific Railroad, Grenville Dodge, Abraham Lincoln's chief engineer, go over to Russia in the 1890s and be the consultant on building the Trans-Siberian Railroad, which was built by the great westernizer of Russia, Count Witte, W-I-T-T-E, who is a follower of Alexander Hamilton and Frederick List, who wanted to modernize Russia by the American methods. Unfortunately, America was already going under British ideology, so Russia had to try to do something there. The Russian Revolution itself, promoted by the British Party and Warburg and Harriman and this whole party, the Russian Revolution itself was designed to defeat the American types in Russia who were doing something in the late period of the Tsars to build up a modern system in Russia. They built up an oil industry, they built railroads, they had tariffs. You know, we tell the people in Russia, don't have the government interfere. We tell them that now. Do what we say, not what we did, to build up our country. But that's how Russia got built up itself before the communists took over. Is they had tariffs, they had public development of railroads, they had public promotion of industry, public promotion of science by science academies. Not communist and not totalitarian. Sometimes they had that, and sometimes they fell back under British influence and had free trade and degeneracy and their industry collapsed. So you had these two systems fighting it out in the world, the British Empire and the United States of America. Our greatest triumph, the greatest moment for us as a nation, was right after the Civil War, when the Confederacy was finished. We had the greatest army in the world. We didn't have the biggest industry in the world, but we're on our way to that with laws passed by Lincoln's government to allow American manufacturers a chance to do something in the market with high tariffs. Cheap credit was available. Public colleges were out there. Private ownership of land by the millions of farms and so forth. At that moment, the world was looking at this spectacle of America as a free country that had finally done in law what its declaration had said about all men are created equal, because we'd abolished slavery. And then you look at the end of the century, only 35 years later, and we fell backwards. We put into effect Jim Crow laws to take back voting rights that had been won in the Civil War. And we were going under British influence in industry and science and technology. We made some progress in the 20th century, but actually most of your inventions that we've had in American history are from the 19th century, are from that period. The electric industry, the electric light, motors, and everything to do with this modern society, with the exception of nuclear energy and spaceflight, is all from the 19th century. And if we keep letting the British run our system, we'll never have nuclear energy or spaceflight in the atom.
Wouldn't it be illogical for the British to promote the Bolshevik Revolution, because that way they would lose an ally in the war against Germany? I can see why they would, in terms of the Russian Revolution, the British supporting it. Once the communists came to power in Russia, they backed out of the war against Germany. And that freed up more German troops in the Eastern Front to fight against the British, and the French.
Yeah, but it doesn't work that way. What you have a movement. What's the war about? Why have a war? Why have the First World War at all? The war is designed to destroy European potential. The war is designed to eliminate one great threat that you have in geopolitics theory. That threat, according to the British, and they write about this in a lot of books, is the threat that you'll have a strong Germany and a strong Russia and a strong China and maybe some other countries, and that these countries might combine with the United States as a strong country. They might all have, not make one country, that's not necessary or good, but that they might be allied to one another, and so much for the power of Britain. And so the idea is that there should never be on the Eurasian landmass any powerful nations that are not somehow in desperate conflict. And you always have war or destabilization against one or more of these countries, particularly to keep Russia and Germany fighting each other. If you have communism in Russia, they may pull out of the war against Germany, but the best prescription for war and madness in Central Europe is to have communism in Russia and Nazism in Germany, right? So you just let the fiends of hell loose on the planet Earth, according to the British theory. Yes, sir.
Tell us how Britain acquired Hong Kong.
Yeah, it cost you $16. Get it in the dope ink book. Seriously, it was a result of the opium war. In the back.
This question in the forum is tied in. What are the gentlemen on the blackboard doing during the rise of Germany, during the era of Bismarck? Isn't German unification completely what these banking houses are against?
Yes. Well, it's slightly complicated. That the first the creation of Germany as a nation starts with the tariff union, the Zollverein, that was promoted by this guy who was in America, Frederick List. He actually was in Pennsylvania helping to organize the development of our industry. He went back as an American consul to Germany. And as a teacher and Republican organizer in the 1830s, and is involved in all kinds of conspiracies, musical conspiracies, poetry, politics. Sounds like these crackpots from the LaRouche organization. Now, he, as an American consul, Frederick List carried musical scores from Schumann to Heine. What's that all about? I don't know. We have to find out a little bit more about these things. There was coordination between the publisher of Schiller, and his name is Kotto. What? Kotta, yeah. The publisher of Schiller, named Kotta, and the publisher of American authors like Cooper, whose name is Matthew Carey. These two publishers were the primary promoters of national unity in their countries. And Kotta was the one who sent List to America. Anyway, List goes back there and he proposes to do two things. To build railroads all over Germany to tie these little principalities together into a modern nation, physically and commercially, and also to have one tariff for the whole of all these German states, to combine them into one, like we did in the American Constitution, that each state doesn't have a tariff against another state. You don't have to pay taxes to go from one state to another, or tariff. But that you have tariffs around your country to protect your whole country from outside dumping. And that was adopted by a lot of these German principalities. And they've also built railroads that began the nation of Germany. There wasn't a nation of Germany before that, the 1830s. List came under terrible pressure. One of the things that was done against List was communism. Frederick Engels and the British national thugs, led by John Bowring and others, would organize Germans in communist meetings against List, saying that he wanted to force Germany to become a manufacturing country, and we communists want to stop that. We communist British aristocrats in the cotton business, you know. But then finally, List was destroyed personally, and they say he committed suicide. I doubt that, but it may have. But he was destroyed by these British operations in the 1840s, and Germany did not emerge as a strong modern nation entirely until Bismarck in the later 1800s. And it was not in a purely Republican form. It was a bad compromise. There were many of the ideas that had been introduced by these American types like List. But already you have people who are mystics in the German leadership. But the Kaiser is no great bargain, you know, by the time of World War I. He's a cousin of the British Empire. And these people are all mystics and infected by all this nonsense British ideology, like Bulwer Lytton and various legends and cults like Wagner, who the Germans make the mistake of thinking as a German composer. He's actually British, and he's totally British.